So thank you all for coming on a Friday afternoon. And this is work that was largely done. All the hard stuff was done by Wei Guang Yao, who did a postdoc in our group and is now doing a second postdoc at Laurentian University. And all the hard microbiology was done by Laura Hurdle, who's a very gifted microbiologist at Western. And, of course, I'm grateful to my funding sources for this project. That would be NSERC and the Ontario Ministry of Science, Technology, and Industry. So viruses, as you may or may not know, need a strategy to ensure their transmission from host to host. Their lifetime, when they're not in a host, is very, very brief, although, as you may know, they can live on door handles, for instance, for quite a long time. But they are obligate parasites, which means they can't survive without their hosts at all. And there are two main classes of viruses. There's the acute, highly contagious virus. So these viruses need to transmit themselves to the next host before one of two things happens. Either the immune system clears the virus or the host dies. And so these viruses need to have a lot of transmission, for instance, lots of coughing or vomiting, something that gets a lot of virus out there in a hurry to infect the next host. And examples are measles, Ebola. There's Ebola right there, nasty-looking little guy. Influenza. And the other class is persistent, long-lasting infections. So these viruses stay with you for a lifetime. They transmit themselves to another host throughout the life of the current host. Examples there would be herpes viruses, HIV, hepatitis, viruses that we don't clear. We live with them for a lifetime once we're infected. Within persistent viral infections, there are two main classes, again, chronic and latent. So for both chronic and latent infection, they're both characterized by long periods of quiescence, when the virus either isn't replicating or is replicating at a very low level. The virus can actually be undetectable in patients for years and years, although it is there. It's in such small concentrations that we don't have the technology right now to detect it. And then there are short bursts of viral production and release. So, for example, in herpes, herpes recurs. The patient is infectious for a while, and then herpes is latent again. So in latent infections, the viral genome truly is silent. So basically, the virus is able to hide within infected cells. And these viruses have exquisite strategies for hiding. They hijack all sorts of bits of cellular machinery to evade the immune system. And they can be truly dormant in cells for a long time. And then some trigger, which is unknown, causes them to start to replicate again and produce a lot of infectious particles and be spread to the next host. Ideally from the virus's point of view. And then in chronic infections, they're a little bit different, except that instead of hiding and being dormant, so the viruses aren't really completely hidden, they're just replicating at a very low level. So they're producing a few infectious particles all the time. So there's continuous low-level viral replication. And then again, for a trigger that is unknown, is thought to start a recurrent episode. So suddenly, the virus has been replicating at a low level for maybe decades, and then suddenly, for reasons that aren't understood, it starts to replicate very quickly. Huge numbers of virion particles are produced within the body. The patient feels ill again. Then the immune system comes in, dampens that, and we go back to the long-lasting chronic infection state. And just out of interest, the picture here is much more complicated than this little vignette that I'm giving you. Some viruses, for example, use both strategies. So Hep B can hide in lymph nodes and in lymphocytes, or peripheral lymphocytes, so those would be white blood cells, cells of the immune system, in the blood. Hep B will be latent, so not producing any infectious particles. But in hepatocytes, the liver cells, simultaneously Hep B would be a chronic infection. So here's Virology 101. Oops, sorry. It's a single slide. This is all you need to know about virology to understand the rest of my talk, I hope. So here's a little schematic. You don't need to be able to read the fine print here. This is a virion, which is like a single virus particle. The virion infects a cell. It hijacks the cellular machinery to produce new virions, which are budded in this example. There are different ways that the virions could be released. In this example, it's budded off the infected cell, and this virion goes on to infect more cells. That's basic virology. And then immunology 101. We need to know a tiny bit more immunology. So again, ignore the fine print. I'll teach you a little bit about the different classes of immune cells. The first class we need to know about is the killer immune cells. Those are called killer T cells, but I'm just going to call them killer cells for this talk and offend no one except Benny, maybe. this is a diagram of an infected cell. See the little virus particles in here? And this is a killer T cell called a cytotoxic T lymphocyte. You don't need to worry about that. And what happens is there's this elaborate docking mechanism, a binding mechanism, whereby the killer cell finds the infected cell, binds to it, and then releases these little messages. And these are basically self-destruct messages. So they tell the infected cell to initiate apoptosis, which means sort of a very controlled sequence of cell death that the cell... So this cell actually kills itself. It gets the signal to kill itself from the killer cell, and then it starts apoptosis. We also need to know about memory cells. So memory cells can be, for example, killer cells. At the end of the immune response, when the virus is almost cleared, you have a lot of CTL in the body and not as much virus, not as many infected cells to kill anymore. And so the CTL actually start to self-destruct, so they undergo apoptosis. And many of them die, but a few of them differentiate into these very long-lived cells. They're called the memory cells of the immune system. And those cells, they're so long-lived, they can live as long as a human lifetime. And that's what gives your immune system its memory, so that when the same infection tries to get you the second time, you're able to mount a very quick response against it. So that's what we call immunity in lay terms. So we'll need to remember that. And as I said, they facilitate a very quick response to the same pathogen when they see it again. And finally, antibodies. So this is not to scale. This is West Nile virus. So that would be a little tiny critter in this picture. And these purple bits are antibodies. Antibodies are just a molecule, not a cell. They're produced by a class of immune cells called B cells. And they basically stick to the virus and neutralize it. They make the virus unable to attach to the cells that it wants to infect, and then the virus that has been coated in antibodies can be eaten up by other immune system cells or cleared or can eventually just fall apart on its own. So this is another way that your body has to attack the virus. So we have a model for chronic viral infection. So if you remember, there was acute and persistent, and then within persistent there was chronic and latent. I'm going to talk about chronic, so low levels of viral replication over years and then sudden bursts of viremia. So in our model, this is sort of a classic model for in theoretical immunology, and I'll point out the ways in which our model is a little bit different from what's been done before as I get there. So we have uninfected cells. You may know that different viruses infect different types of cells in the body. And this model is sufficiently general that we don't need to specify that these are uninfected lymphocytes, for instance. If we were modeling HIV, they would be, because HIV only infects lymphocytes. But we're keeping it general at this point. Then infected cells. Z is the killer cells of the immune system. So for Benny, those are activated virus-specific CTL. U is antibodies, again, virus-specific. And V is the free virus. That's the virus that's floating around in your system, hasn't infected a cell yet. So for the uninfected cells, I'm going to use prime. I once heard this great joke about, the Eskimos have so many words for snow, and mathematicians have so many ways to denote differentiation. So this is DXDT. And all of the parameters, that D is... Historically, D has been used as that parameter, so unfortunately that looks like a DX, but that's a positive parameter D times X for historical reasons. And all the parameters are positive. So we'll have, these cells are produced from some precursor pool of cells at a constant rate, lambda. They have a natural death rate, D. And this is a mass action term. V, you recall, is the free virus floating around in the system. So free virus bumps into uninfected cells and then we lose an uninfected cell, and as you'll see in a moment, we gain an infected cell, and that happens at rate beta. And this, the most heinous assumption here is that we produce the uninfected cells at a constant rate, and I'll relax that in a model that you'll see in just a second. Free virus. U is not in here, but it's antibody. Do you want to? I can go back. I'm going to go through them all one by one now. So now infected cell, dy/dt. Here is the influx from the infection of uninfected cells, like we just described. They also have a natural death rate. So in general, their natural death rate would be faster than the uninfected cells. And here, this is another mass action term. Y is the infected cells, and Z is the killer cells. So again, a killer cell bumps into an infected cell via mass action kinetics, and the killing rate or efficacy of the CTL response is P. Okay. And, no, I won't say anything yet about that. And the killer cells, so dz/dt, we have a proliferation rate. So here there are some assumptions built in, and these are assumptions that we will also relax and investigate whether they change the conclusions of our model shortly. So we have the killer cells are proliferating at rate Cy. So C is a constant, and Y is the infected cells. So our underlying assumption is that the proliferation of the immune response killer cells is proportional to the number of infected cells that are out there. And actually, that happens through a series of complex intermediate steps. But we're using Y sort of as a surrogate for how severe the infection is right now. And depending on how severe the infection is, how many infected cells there are, then the killer T cell response is mounted proportionally. Okay, and I'll show you some other assumptions that we could make instead of that one. They have a natural death rate. And here we introduce the long-lived memory cells. So that's Z sub M. When the host first experiences a new pathogen, so the brand new infection, we would set that to zero. But for modeling long-term, these recurrent infections or chronic infections, we set ZM to a constant. Now, in reality, having seen a certain pathogen, you would have a certain number of memory. These are memory T cells, and that would decay very slowly over the lifetime of the host. So we're neglecting that decay in this model. And then the new killer cells are produced from the memory cells, again, at a rate that's proportional to the number of infected cells, so at a rate proportional to the severity of the infection at this time. We're almost there. It's five populations. This is number four. So DUD2, this is the antibodies. The antibodies now... Let's start here. These are the easier terms. Antibodies decay with a natural decay rate. So they basically fall apart or are cleared. You pee them out. And antibodies bind to free virus. And they sort of get mopped up because they're sticking to those free virus molecules. And they disappear that way. And here we have the production rate of antibodies proportional to the killer T cells. And really, antibodies are produced by the B cells. Right, so you need to have activated virus-specific B cells. And B cells and T cells, though, their responses are mounted together. They're activated and proliferate by very similar mechanisms in the lymph node. So again, this is a simplifying assumption that I will relax in a moment. But for the simplest possible model, we say that the production of antibodies is proportional to the killer T cell population. Yep. So these would all be cell densities per microliter, for example. And finally, free virus. So four terms, but this is fairly straightforward. So free virus is produced by infected cells. It's neutralized by antibodies, so it disappears as it's neutralized by the antibody. The free virus binds to uninfected cells to produce the infected cells. That was one of the first terms that we did, the beta. And so this models how the free virus is lost. This term is typically neglected in these kinds of models, but in our model we wanted to be able to accurately characterize very, very low levels of viral replication. And when you have a lot of uninfected cells and very, very low levels of virus, then this term can become important, this loss of the viral population as it infects cells, right? And there's a natural clearance rate of the free virus.
Oh.
You're absolutely right. So on the train on the way here, I found a typo. Yeah, that K should be, there should be a K1 and a K2. You're absolutely right. Does everyone see that? When you picture that picture of the virion mopped up with purple antibodies stuck to it, it's not one-to-one, right? So that K has to be a little bit different. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I've repeated the typo here. I apologize, so. This K should not really be the same as that K. Yeah? It's a separate variable. For the moment, it's constant, and then we relax that in a moment. So there's the whole picture. And what's different about it is this term in part, which I just mentioned, that we care about virus being lost as it infects cells. What's also different is ZM, that we've modeled the long-term memory response, which we think is really important for these long-term persistent infections. And we've got killer T cells and antibodies separately. And there are some models out there, many models out there, that have killer T cells and a couple that have antibodies. But usually they're amalgamated in some sort of generic immune response. And so this model's a little different in that we've taken those two apart, and that's actually essential to our results. Okay. So now I'll show you, we actually that was the basic model, and then we expanded and tried to figure out which assumptions our conclusions might be sensitive to and relaxed the worst of the assumptions, or the least justifiable, I guess, in many ways. And I think we did 7 or 8 different versions of the model. And the results that I'll show you today were common to all of those 7 or 8 versions. But I'll tell you what they were, just out of interest. So one was this infected cells being produced at a constant rate from a precursor pool. Depends on the uninfected cell type. So some cells are produced by precursors. Other cells can be produced or proliferate, produce themselves. And in general, many cell types would have some sort of density-dependent production. So here we just made some more complicated assumptions where we have both proliferation, production and proliferation, and it's density dependent, which depends on both whether the cell is uninfected or infected. It's still taking up resource in our density dependence. Another model that we looked at had a more complicated density dependent proliferation rate for the killer T cells. I guess that's pretty self-explanatory. And finally, I think actually this is where we began. So historically, we started with this model and then realized that we didn't need to keep the B cells in there because they weren't contributing anything except a lot more mathematical complexity to our system. So this is what we ended up with for antibodies. The antibodies produced at a rate proportional to the killer T cells. But what you'd really like to see is the antibodies being produced proportional to a population of B cells. And those are the cells that I said in Immunology 101 actually produce the antibodies. They're a separate type of immune cells. And then you'd want to model the B cells as a dynamic variable. So these would be virus-specific activated B cells. And they would be produced proportionally to infected cells. So again, that's through antigen-presenting cells, so a lot of intermediary steps are hidden in there, but we assume that it's proportional to the infection, the severity of the infection at that time point. The B cells have their own natural death rate, and the B cells can also be produced from a pool of memory B cells in the same way that the T cells are. And I won't give you all the details because I think it's you know, kind of more of the same, more and more complicated models, we let the memory T cells, so the memory killer cells, be a dynamic variable. So they would be activated and have their own natural death rate and the whole bit, and they would be another separate variable in the system. Likewise, the memory B cells. One assumption which is kind of hidden in our model is that the killer cells that are differentiated from the memory cells live, in reality, they live longer than normal, quote-unquote, killer cells. But in our model, they're identical. So we relaxed that and treated them separately. Because these memory cells, when they become reactivated, they have a very long lifetime. And likewise for the B cells, the ones that are differentiated from the memory cells should live longer than the normal B cells. So we looked at that as well. Okay. And there were subtle differences with all of these models, but the main points that I'll show you today, as I said, were common to all. So we got a Tokens-Bogdanoff bifurcation. I had to look that up. So let me remind you what the variables are. This is the infected cells, and they're produced when uninfected cells meet virus, and that's that mass action rate constant beta. So beta is often called the infectivity of the virus. And I also wanted to remind you that the free virus, its decay rate is Q. And Wei Guang noticed just from playing with the mathematics that he could get much, much further analytically if Q were zero. Which is not justified biologically, but we decided to do the analysis there and then see if we could relax that assumption after we had some insight. So when Q is zero, which would mean that any virus that's produced has to be mopped up by the immune system, it doesn't decay away naturally on its own at all. It doesn't mean that the virus lasts forever because the immune system is mopping it up quite effectively. In that case, then we can rigorously prove that there's a critical value of this infectivity beta, and if beta is less than the critical value, the virus will be cleared by the immune system, so we won't have persistent infection. If you introduce virus, the virus grows, the infected cells grow, then the killer T cells come in, then the antibody response comes in, brings everything back down to zero. End of story. And if B is greater than B critical, then we found a Hopf bifurcation with leading eigenvalue zero. That's what a Tokens-Bogdanoff bifurcation is, Wei Guang taught me. And we also see this beautiful periodic state in that case. So in the periodic state, the system is cycling through a trajectory through to state space. There's a virus-free equilibrium, so that's healthy. And the system has a very slow velocity near the virus-free equilibrium. And then it goes through state space very quickly past a virus-persistent equilibrium and then back to very close to the virus-free equilibrium and stays there for a long time. I've got a movie. I'll show you a movie in a second. Just out of interest, both of these equilibria are unstable. That's why we're not ending up at either of them. And Wei Guang was also able to prove that as beta approaches the critical value of beta from above, the period of this cycle, which I've denoted T, approaches infinity. So it can be as long as you want, this cycle. And that was of interest to us because in recurrent infection, the cycle is maybe decades. So I guess I will show you the movie. Oh, our rescaling of the screens didn't work. Oh, that's unfortunate. I wonder if I can fix that. How badly do you want to see the movie? Sure. I can. No. Oh, come on, now what's happening? I made it smaller but failed to give it to you. Well, you can sort of imagine. Along here is the infected cells, and along here is killer T T cells, and your infection starts and it goes around here, and then the little red dot sits right here for a long time, and then it goes zoom there, and then it sits there for a long time near this virus-free equilibrium, and then it goes zoom. Right, so that's the phase plane portrait. This is like the first time I've given a movie and a talk, and I was so excited about it. Oh, that's a really good question. Somewhere out on the top right, but I don't know exactly where. But where was the virus persistent equilibrium? So the other unstable equilibrium. So, yeah, I think it goes quite close. So I think... there are your axes. You spend a lot of time here, and then you go zoom, and I think it's somewhere out there. This was infected cells and killer T cells. So sort of infection and immune response. Or time is just as it travels, as it goes around. But you could think of it about this way. Yep. Yep. Okay. So as I said, this assumption that the virus doesn't decay on its own is mathematically very convenient, but not at all justified biologically. So of course we had to relax it. And when Q is greater than zero and the virus does decay naturally, it decays naturally with a half-life of about 8 hours, by the way. So we do need to include that. That's not a negligible decay rate. We still have a periodic trajectory, and we can't prove very much about the period. But we can show that it's bounded. And numerically, we can see that it can be very, very long with realistic parameter values, decades even. Speaking of the parameter values, I meant to tell you when I had the slide up there with all the parameters, so there's a system of 5 differential equations. The parameters that are in the linear terms, we can pretty much know because they give us, we know that what the mean lifetime of a cell is, therefore we know what the natural death rate of the cell is. We know how long on average the antibody sticks around. So those terms we know. But all of the mass action kinetic rate constants are, of course, very difficult to pin down. But we also have estimates of the equilibrium. So for the virus persistent equilibrium, we have order of magnitude estimates of how many cells there are around, how many killer cells, how many antibodies around. And so that gives us 5 more parameters. And then R0 gives us 1 more. R0 is the basic reproductive ratio. And we know that it's not going to be 20, and we know it's greater than 1. So that also gives us an order of magnitude estimate of 1 more parameter. So we have none of the parameters, I would say, are pinned down at all, but I would say all of the simulations and data that I'll show you are realistic parameter values.
Can the model consider our possibility that the virus is not seen by the immune system?
No, so this is all chronic infection and no latent. That's what I would call latent infection, yeah, and it's all chronic infection. So that's the same data as the phase plane plot, but you can see this is the uninfected cells dipping down and coming back to equilibrium, infected cells coming up in concert, and the free virus is actually almost always proportional to the infected cells. In retrospect, we probably could neglect this population from the model. And here are the killer T cells coming in, and then the antibodies coming in just after the killer T cells. And to get a better idea of the timing, I'll show you another. So the same data, slightly different parameter values, and everything rescales so that we can see the relative timing. So here are the uninfected cells, X. So out here, and actually off the end of the screen, is the period of dormancy, the quiescent period between recurrent infections, when you have lots of uninfected cells and very little virus, very few infected cells. So the infected cells are Y, and the virus, those are these two lines that go in concert here. So they start to come up, and as they start to come up, the immune system begins to respond. There's the CTL. The killer cells come up. That brings the infected cells down. And then the antibody comes up, and that really brings the infected cells and the virus down to almost zero. And the antibody, you see, is very long-lived. So the half-life, or the mean lifetime, is about 5 days for the CTL and about 20 days for the antibody. So it's quite a big difference. And then, but the virus and the infected cells don't completely ever disappear, and so after some time, the whole thing starts over again. So there were three, we looked at the period between recurrences and the severity of the recurrences when they happen. And there were sort of three main conclusions that we had. One is that the period gets longer and the severity gets higher when the antibodies are more effective. Okay, so that if the antibodies are more effective, there's a longer time before the virus recurs. That makes intuitive sense. And this is why max is the peak value of the infected cells when they do recur. And it also goes up as we wait longer between infections. And in this case, the point of the inset here is that when you're out here on this plateau, Y doesn't really, the peaks can't get any higher, but they last for longer. And because the lifetime of each cell hasn't changed, this means that more cells are getting infected in this case. So we would still say that the severity is worse. Yeah, I'm going to talk about that after the next. But yeah, you're exactly right. So the intuition was, if you wait longer, then the antibodies and the T cells as well, the immune response has basically decayed away to almost nothing when the virus recurs, and therefore when it does recur, it's more severe. This is a little bit more counterintuitive. So this is the efficacy of the killer T cells, how quickly and effectively they can kill infected cells. And if they get more effective, then the period actually gets shorter. So this was a surprise to us. We scratched our heads quite a bit about that. And in concert with that, when the period is shorter, the severity is smaller, less, reduced, I guess. So our intuition about this is that there's kind of a competition, in a sense, between the killer T cells and the antibody in clearing the virus. And remember, the T cells come first. And if the T cells do a very efficient job, way out here, then the antibodies, there's less of an antibody response mounted. The antibodies do less of the job. And remember, the antibodies have this longer half-life, and they keep recurrence from happening. So if the CTL do a really good job, then there's a smaller antibody response, and therefore the recurrence happens more quickly, and then is less severe when it does happen. And likewise, with this is the size of the memory response. So how effective is, can the memory T cells be reactivated to fight the virus? And again, if the memory response is more effective, the period is reduced and the severity is reduced. And I think that's for the same reason. We just have more T cells fighting the virus and less of an antibody response. And finally, we were interested in fluctuations, random fluctuations in host health, which can mean a lot of things. So people believe, I think it's well established that diet and exercise and exposure to sunlight and any stressors in your life can trigger recurrent episodes for these chronic viruses. And what's unknown is exactly what the triggers are, how they work, and in some cases they seem to recur without a trigger, and so there's a lot of open questions there. And we ran our same model, but we just let the uninfected cells or the infected cells or the T cells have a very tiny white noise term, so we just added that numerically. And then we found, it's not coming out very well. So the basic model before without any fluctuations is the solid line. And can you see this little dashed line? These are the recurrent episodes when we added fluctuations. So the fluctuations can trigger earlier recurrences, and then when they're earlier, they're less severe, consistent with what we've seen already. So, I plan to back up a tiny bit and talk about these four results again. So this is the antibody effect, the fact that having more effective antibodies will lengthen the period between recurrences. And so this fits in well with the idea of doing antibody therapy. So some, I don't know, is this done or just been suggested, antibody therapy?
Antibody therapy is short.
Short, yeah. Right. Yeah. So some people have suggested antibody therapy might work for these chronic infections. And our predictions would be that that might work, that if you had enough antibody, you could delay recurrence past the lifetime of the host. But you're kind of playing with fire, because if you don't delay it quite past the lifetime of the host, you could get an incredibly severe recurrence when recurrence happens. The killer T cell, what I was going to tell you here was about the competition. I'm going to explain it all, about the competition between the T cells and the antibody response. So we've been there, done that. And here, memory effect. This is quite interesting. Anecdotally, one of my collaborators works with cytomegalovirus, CMV, which is one of these chronic infections that a large fraction of the population carries this virus, and you never even know it, and it doesn't cause any problems. And it's believed to have recurrent episodes very frequently indeed, but they're small, short-lived, your body clears, well, it doesn't clear it, dampens the episode, and it goes back to the chronic, low viral replication state. And interestingly, individuals that are infected with CMV have a huge memory T cell response to CMV. So you're carrying around a large number of memory cells, and yet this virus recurs all the time, very frequently at a low level, which is completely consistent with what we found here, that if you have very strong memory responses, you should have a very short period between recurrences. And that is probably counterintuitive at first glance. It's so counterintuitive, I don't care. So this is basically the memory effect. The memory effect getting stronger in that direction, and this is getting more frequent. The period going down, so more and more frequent responses.
Sort of explain. I thought the explanation was what you said would be the
killer cells, and the antibody.
Yeah, the antibodies is dying to the thing, and they have a longer period. Isn't that right? And then.
Yes, it's the same explanation. Are you okay with the killer cells? Why the killer cells and the antibodies have opposite effects? Maybe not. I'll just do it. So this is the same thing. As the killer cells get more effective, you get more frequent infection. And that's because when the killer cells are more effective, they're kind of in competition for mopping up the virus with the antibody. And if they're very effective, then you don't need to mount a very big antibody response. But the antibodies are the ones with the long half-life that keep recurrences from happening frequently. So if you do all your mopping up with killer cells, then the recurrence can happen more quickly. And it's exactly the same explanation here, because the memory response, if I could, it's kind of hard to flip back to the whole model. Yeah. That's a good question. I haven't looked at it. It's so close to zero. You know, I've never really compared on a semi-log plot, for instance. I don't know about the troughs. But I think that my intuition anyway is that it's not so much about the troughs for the infection, but it's about the killer response and the antibody response. And their troughs. So they're going down, killer responds to the infection and then decays away, and antibody comes later and decays away more slowly. And if this guy is huge, and this guy doesn't get stimulated as much, and goes down to some level which allows the virus to grow back up more quickly.
Is it that sort of relationship that if your antibodies respond to size, then your killer cells are actually smaller?
No, I wouldn't go that far in general. But I would say in face of one peak of viremia, so these are your infected cells or your virus, in our situation when we're fighting them with both of these two arms of the immune system, we observe that when we make these guys more affected, and it might not be that there are more of them, it's just that they're more effective. It could be more of them at the same efficacy, or it could be fewer of them, but however, in bulk, they're more effective. Then the antibody is just slower to mount, it's a little slower to mount as well, and so more of the virus is decayed away, and so you get a smaller antibody response. But I wouldn't say in general that they're anti-correlated. I mean, still they're coming up together to fight the same virus, right? Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, and these can be tiny. I mean, 10 to the minus 3 might even not be that small. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. I mean, my argument is about how low this goes, right? And I haven't really investigated that, and that's a good point. And so the memory response, that just feeds into the Z, the killer response. It's just part of the Z term, right? So if you increase H, I guess is what we've plotted there, you increase your killer cells. So it has the same effect as increasing the killer efficacy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It doesn't go. If it went to zero, it would be a completely different story. It doesn't go to zero. That's yeah.
There's one thing I noticed in the module, and I didn't comment at that time, but I got the mathematics. You were multiplying your Z when they're coming compared to Y.
Mm-hmm. Proliferating. Yes, so that's, do you remember my little, and there's intermediaries and we know it's complicated, but, yeah.
The M will multiply, not Z is killing the Y, not multiplying at the same
time. But Z is proliferating in response to antigen-presenting cells.
Yeah, but the Z is the killer cell.
Mm-hmm.
It's killing. It will multiply, actually, it will multiply only when it is in the resting mode.
So you say activated virus-specific CTL will not proliferate.
Yeah, when a CTL goes to kill an infected cell, it kills.
Well, we'll talk later. So, those are the big conclusions, that in general, you can move between more frequent, less severe recurrence and less frequent, more severe recurrence. And these are the factors that move you in this direction. Higher antibody efficacy, lower killer T cell efficiency, lower memory T cell efficiency, and lower viral infectivity I didn't show you today. That also moved in that direction. And the really exciting, I haven't highlighted this yet, but the exciting thing was that we found these recurrences without any exogenous triggers. So people have been searching, and this is an unanswered question, what are the triggers? Are the triggers different? Why haven't we found the specific triggers? And the prediction that we have, or the hypothesis, I mean, this is very much at hypothesis level, obviously, is that maybe for some infections there doesn't need to be a trigger. The system is just naturally cycling through state space, and it spends a long time here just naturally. And some triggers can bump it a little bit faster around the circle, but it's not like it's waiting there for some specific trigger to then go, right? It would naturally go on its own if you waited long enough. And that's basically it, I think. Yep, that's it. Thank you.
Actually, this is exactly what we also see in population level, interfacing between immunity and recurrence at another place. What the example means. The epilepsy vaccination itself leaves.
Right.
Even. So it is some kind of interfacing between pathogen multiplication and immunity within an individual is what is.
That's really interesting. Yeah, and can you think of, see what we needed with these two different half-lives of the CTL and the N. My intuition is that that's what's essential to get this. So I wonder what the two half-lives would be at a population level. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
How the big cycle that's in the fluctuation case, that you see the recurrent episodes, is that irregular length between them?
Mm-hmm.
So it's an exponential waiting time, like, well,
yeah, I didn't.
But
I assume.
Is the picture then the fluctuations, this thing is waiting around down near the origin, and then it gets moved around until it lands in a fast region and then moves around?
Yeah, I think so.
So it's more likely to hit one of the smaller cycles than one of the longer, more severe cycles.
Hmm. Well, it's not just waiting because it's moving as well, right? But my point is that as it moves, it's moving through areas where the recurrence would be smaller towards areas where the recurrence would be larger. From all the other work that we've seen, that the less frequent and more less I can't do it anymore. More frequent, less severe. Come together, and less frequent, more severe come together. So as it's moving along, if it gets bumped up to a place where it'll go around, it gets bumped up earlier. So that's where it's less severe, I think.
Mm-hmm.
No, we don't have multiple viruses. Yeah, they're parameters for humans, and they're parameters in some cases for specific viruses. All our parameters are sort of order of magnitude. But I didn't mention that, as well as being robust to all of these different models, these main conclusions were robust to a wide range of parameter space that we explored. And in fact, for Q equals zero, we can prove that they're always true. That's a really good question. Then you can tell us. So as I said, the lifetimes of the cells, it's very easy. And for the mass action terms, it's almost impossible. And you try to get them from the equilibrium population sizes, for example, from other factors that you can measure, because you can't actually measure that.
Well,
if you have enough memory T cells in response, you can actually move the systems to a very low chronic state that never recurs, and we can prove that as well. And so that can be done in mice, where you can just give them a lot of memory cells, right? But we can't do that in humans. Likewise, if you can give enough antibody, like we discussed, you could control the system and move it to a point where the recurrence is infinitely far away. But, in both cases, you're kind of playing with fire.
But can you do the phase of the setting so that when it goes up again, you have too high the ability.
Mm-hmm.
Control it.